Welcome back to another episode of the Huxley Morton podcast, the show where each week we speak to pharma company owners and industry leaders sharing their stories of personal and professional growth. We're now on series four of the show, and as you may already be aware, we're on a mission to help clinical researchers from around the world with tips, tricks, and inspiration. So if you could do me a quick favor and please hit that follow or subscribe button, it really does help more than you'll ever know. Once again, Adam Walker is alongside me, so sit back, relax, and we'll take things from here. This week, Adam and I are joined by Michelle Shogren, or Shogren, I'm not sure. Michelle, you have to fill me in on that. Michelle is the founder and CEO at Innovate in What You Do. So a little bit on one that I'm quite interested to find out about this, Michelle. First of all, give me the heads up on your name for the audience so that we've got that correct.
It's Shogren, like you're going to show your grin. So pretty easy to remember, but you did great.
Good. Well, I always like to get these things right, so I thought I better kick off on the right foot there. But look, Innovate in What You Do, it's quite an unusual name for a business. Normally, you know, when we have people on, it's pharma company owners, biotech company owners, drug discovery. You know, this is a little bit unique. So look, give us a quick overview. You know, if you were to explain to your friends out over a drink, you know, about your role and what the company does effectively.
Yeah, so my company is all about trying to innovate clinical trials and do that within the ground that people work in. So not trying to innovate by changing how somebody else operates or somebody else talks or works or something like that, but really in the space that they're in, but by leveraging the users in that ecosystem and their knowledge and their voice. So it's really kind of trying to bridge the silos that are created in the clinical trial ecosystem by bringing in the voice of sponsor companies, CROs, sites, patients, caregivers, patient advocacy groups, solution providers even, and bringing them all to the table when you're trying to create those new solutions or ways of working so you have a better chance of success in the end.
Okay. So who would be your, I guess, typical client? Your services, who are you providing these to?
That's the great thing. So I've been in the clinical trial area now for 25 years, and I've held several different roles across the spectrum. Yeah. And now I get to work with all of them again. So currently I have clients, I have two pharma clients, I have four different solution provider clients, I have one site, and I have one patient advocacy group. And they're all looking at different things that they're wanting to improve on or become more efficient on, or figure out how can they move the ball to the right person in order to actually make a play.
Sure. So look, let's take a step back there. You said that you've got 25 years in the industry. Just give us a quick overview of, how did you get into the industry to start with? If you were to give us a very quick run through of your background and experience to bring you up to this point, that'd be amazing.
Sure. I think probably a lot of people in clinical trial space, it fell into research, right? We didn't necessarily plan to be there. I guess some of the people who work in bench research probably actually had that as a goal, but many of us fell into it. And I was one of those people. I started out as a nurse, and my friend upstairs started going to really cool places and showing up with a nice bag or a pair of shoes. And I'm like, wait a minute, we make the same amount of money. How are you getting to do these things or ending up with these kind of, you know, trinkets, so to speak? And she says, oh, well, I'm working in clinical trials. And I said, okay, tell me more. What's happening there? And she says, well, we do studies to make sure they're safe and effective. And we get trained at some location, which we call an investigator meeting. And so they bring all the doctors and nurses that are running the clinical trials to one place, and they teach us how to do things. So that's where the trips come from. And then when I do something really well at work, so say we had an audit or an inspection and everything went well and I gave high quality, sometimes we would get a reward and have a little bit of money or a surprise gift or something like that. And that's where maybe the purse or the shoes come from. So I was like, oh, this sounds really interesting. And I wanted to get on board. So I convinced the doctor that I was working for in the same building that we needed to have a conversation about this and it might be a good option. Because she also explained that it was extremely rewarding for her to be able to offer new things to their patients that mm-hmm. weren't really being taken care of by what was currently out there and available. And yeah, now they yeah. were able to offer this research. So I said, okay, this makes sense. So I talked to my doctor about it and we started a research site.
Wow. So you kind of just that initial curiosity has kind of led you to then spending 25 years in the industry and now starting your own business. So where, you know, in terms of your the background, where did this business idea come from? I mean, when did you found the business? When did things start?
That actually just recently happened. I was with Bayer Pharmaceuticals for 14 mm-hmm. years, and I left them the end of June because of a family medical situation with my mother. Mm-hmm. And I needed to be able to not travel internationally every 2 weeks, which my job required at the time. And I thought, how can I be home more and have a more flexible schedule, but still help people? Because with every job change I made throughout my career, I was able to exponentially help more people. And yeah. I thought, you know, I've been running an innovation function for the last 6 years in pharma, and I really saw it being able to bridge these silos that were naturally forming anyways. Mm-hmm. I thought maybe if I could do the same thing and not just focus on one company, but be able to focus on multiple different companies and different stakeholders in the ecosystem, maybe I can make a difference and be able to help even more people. So that would also give me the flexibility to decide when I traveled and if I traveled and create a team of people who have a diverse background to help me kind of also solve the client's needs. And it seemed like a win-win. So we actually launched officially September 6th. And I started working though in July already. My plan was to take July and August off, but I had a lot of people already interested and wanting to come to me before I went live. And
nice problem
really great
to have.
Yeah. It turned out really well.
Interesting. So look, just for, I guess perhaps my benefit more so than many of our audience, I can imagine. Explain to me the kind of challenges that we typically face. So in your job with Bayer, for example, you were in charge of the innovation and bringing silos together. What does that mean to, I guess, someone who's not necessarily in the industry? When you talk about silos, bringing it together, a collaboration, if you were to explain it to a six-year-old or myself, because we're fairly similar, how does that work?
So I think research tells us anytime you have more than 109 people together, a silo will form. They will say, hey, we seem to look and act and talk very similarly. Let's create a clique. Right. Uh-huh. And we're drawn together and we're very proud of what we do and how we do it. And then there becomes this ownership of this area that we fit in. Mm-hmm. Right. And it doesn't matter. You can try to break them down. Everybody talks about let's break silos and we'll work together better. And it doesn't really work. The psychology behind it tells us it's not going to work. You're not going to break the silos without losing some of the things that make those people wonderful and those roles wonderful. You don't mm-hmm. want to make a weakness by getting rid of a strength. So with innovation, what we were finding is in order to do new ways of working, we're in this paradigm shift right now for clinical trials. We had the traditional way of working for a long, long time. Patients would go into their doctor's office every 4 to 6 weeks. You would have medications, exams. You'd see them for that speck of time that they were there in front of you. And then they would be gone until they came back in again. Right. And it worked. It worked for a long time. But now technology is creeping up and awareness is creeping up. And we're realizing we're only reaching 5% of the population. There's 95% of the population that don't even realize that clinical trials could be a care option for them, or they have more choices out there than what's currently available on the market. Mm-hmm. And there are huge disparities on who has access, and technology is giving us ways to be able to say, you know what, we can do this in a more flexible manner. We can have it more community set situations, more home-based opportunities to interact with these individuals and allow people who were never able to do a clinical trial now to do one. But yeah, that creates an oh no moment on the pharma side. It creates an oh no moment on the research side of things. And we have to figure out, how do we work this way? And that's where innovation comes in. That's where you try to figure out what does this invention need to make it actually implementable for it to be called an innovation? Because it's really not until it can be operationalized.
It sounds like, Michelle, you're describing the shift from the old way to the new way, or kind of in a light touch decentralized manner. Is that fair?
Absolutely.
Is that correct? So effectively bringing patients closer to the physician by giving them routes of access, namely technology, patient recorded outcome devices, patient apps, maybe a window, you know, a virtual window, like we would call like a fancy FaceTime, or, you know, a medical virtual window to the patient. Is that the kind of thing that you're describing and innovating around?
Exactly. So we're trying to help people figure out how to make that really work and really look at the operational burden of those kind of things, but look at the value drivers, look at the benefits first before we talking about all of these challenges that are there. And then we're better suited to be able to mitigate those challenges.
Awesome. So that I'm clear on this. So it's not necessarily that you're developing apps or technology or algorithms to take in. You're talking about what people are already using, but how better to use, almost kind of in a management consultancy-esque way. Am I getting that correct?
Somewhat. Yeah, somewhat. I'm not creating new medicines. I'm not creating new technology itself. I am helping people to innovate what they've already created and find ways to make it where it'll actually be received. So many people create things and they throw it over the fence and they say, here, catch this, go use it now. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't work. So by doing innovation workshops and doing user workshops or focus groups or sounding boards, you can bring in the people that actually have to interact with whatever you're creating. So if you're a solution provider and I've created the next best e-consent, for example, and we think it makes perfect sense and we don't understand, why is nobody taking this up? How come they're not putting it into their studies? Why aren't, you know, all these patients using e-consent now? Yeah. Well, by doing these workshops and user testing and focus groups, we can find out really why is that? What can we do differently? What can we either communicate better about? What can we change or tweak to make it where it'll actually work in a real setting at a doctor's office or at a home location, wherever you're trying to do this consent process?
So you're kind of talking about adoption. All of this new technology is absolutely incredible, but if people don't know how to use it, don't know how to implement it, can't be bothered to actually start doing it, it's worthless. So look, when you walk into, say, a pharma client, a biotech client, and you say to them, look, what are the biggest challenges that you're facing with adoption, or, you know, the typical challenges that you would be there to solve, what are they saying to you?
So it depends on who that client is. So for pharma clients, what I'm hearing from them, they are finding that even within their own study teams, being able to understand what the impact of this technology is going to be on them and their lives and how much burden is it going to cause them, that makes a fear where they'll say, oh, that sounds like a great idea. I can see the value, but not in my study. And they're like, how do I get them to say, yes, please, in my study? Yeah. So that's one of the things, is we have to be able to better explain how something is going to impact them and where those value drivers are for them. Mm-hmm. For solution providers, it's a little different. For solution providers, they're coming in and they're saying, hey, we want to sell this to pharma maybe, or we want to be able to get CROs to use this, but we're having trouble. We're not able to figure out who's the decision maker. I call them the high five. Everybody needs to know who your high five is. Mm-hmm. And that's even if you're trying to innovate within your own company, you have a high five too. There's always the decision maker who you want to give the thumbs up, right? Then you have the budget holder who they want to be number one, because they hold the money. And then you have the three main influencers. So almost every solution or idea out there, they're going to have three different types of people that they're going to interact with. So you have to figure out who they are, and you want them to say, it's okay for that decision maker to say yes to it. So the solution providers are trying to figure out, who are my high five? Who, you know, how do I talk to them? What are the values that they care about? But sometimes they also want to find out, about their users. Like, I think this is good. It seems like patients would want to use this, but I'm not really sure. How do I find out if a patient would use this or not? And would they use it throughout the entire study, or would they use it a couple times and then stop using it, which is a big risk? And how can I have the data to show to somebody who wants to buy this from me that they would be willing to use it?
Perhaps a weird question here, talking about, just thinking of your high five and kind of almost the sales and business development side of things, which I'm used to. A lot of this technology is fairly new, but the solution providers might be looking to sell to pharma. So I'm just sitting there wondering, would they have a budget for something that they don't necessarily know about yet? So is it a case that you almost have to help them find out what problem the client doesn't even know that they have yet, so that you can solve it? Because, you know, you can't expect someone to have a budget for something that they don't know might be a benefit for them. So it sounds as though you must have to be very shrewd in the fact that you could spot an opportunity for these service providers to almost sell their solution better than what they can, Michelle.
Well, I would say that that's partly right. So in a situation for a traditional trial, you may not necessarily have a budget for an e-consent, just using that, because we use that already.
Sure.
You might not have a budget for an e-consent. However, you do have a budget for a regular consent form, you know, because there's going to be IRB fees that are necessary or ethics committee fees that are necessary. You're going to have a certain amount of time and resources that you're putting towards that, all these other things. So you have some budget to work with. What you want them to do is often expand that budget a little bit to be able to do something a little more advanced and enhanced. And you have to be able to solidify that it's worth the extra cost, because you're going to have an extra impact somewhere. So what is that return on investment? Yeah. I used to sell Kirby vacuum cleaners. I don't know if you guys have that over in the UK, but they're like these fancy vacuum cleaners. And I sold them in Southeast Texas when I was going to school. And they're like $1,400 vacuum cleaners back in the day. And that was being sold to people who their monthly salary was $1,400. Wow. So it was a challenge to sell them, but it's one of those things where if the benefits are there, people will find a way to get the money.
That budget side of things, you know, it's like no one has a budget set aside for if their, you know, car breaks down and things like this. It's a case of you always go and find the budget if the problem is going to cost you more than the solution. And that's where I guess you come in, and that, you know, background in pharma and the business development and innovation is clearly paying dividends, because now you're able to transfer that to, you know, the people that you're working with. Adam, it looks like you want to add something there as well.
Well, as you were describing, Michelle, the approach to e-consent, and I was just thinking about some of the benefits to going e-consent, namely, you know, real-time data that you can see what's happening in real time. You can direct your efforts to particular sites and particular regions, therapeutic areas, sense of excellence, key opinion leaders, whatever those things, you know, geographical location. But it also reminded me a little bit of, you know, again, the old days when, you know, we used to collect ECRF data on paper, dare I say it. And we had a similar sort of argument around that. You know, my background is in biometrics and data. So I remember real old school, you know, chalkboard and slates. No, I'm being flippant, but as a serious point, it sounds a bit like that kind of adoption. You know, it's the transfer of paper, electronic, real time, but actually the efficiencies of scale, never mind the efficiencies of technological advancement, are so great now and so have been so rapidly adopted, I would say, certainly during COVID times. You know, decentralized is a thing, but certainly adoption of technology is now a thing, isn't it? You know, if sites are saying, well, we don't really fancy that, I wouldn't imagine they're that forward thinking, and they're pretty old school. So the effort that you're doing is educating, isn't it, really?
There is definitely some education to it, but I wouldn't say that they're not forward thinking if they say no. Sometimes you can be forward thinking, but your day-to-day operations prevent you so much from doing it. So with e-consent at a site, you say, okay, well, they adopted it during COVID and they needed to, but during COVID, they didn't have patients in the waiting rooms. If you have a site and you have three waiting rooms and you have to change them out every 15 minutes, then how do you have somebody sit in a waiting room, watch an e-consent or interact with the e-consent for an hour? And that drops you to two exam rooms. So sorry, my dog's had a lot
to say. That's right. He's pitching in. So is it he or is she?
I have two, and they're both boys. And normally they're not noisy, so sorry.
No worries.
But they've obviously got an opinion on e-consent as well.
And they do. They said they love it.
They're reinforcing your point.
Yes, sorry for that.
That's okay. Well, look, I guess on the subject of that, I mean, clearly, you know, if you're at home with the boys, as it may be, the dogs, but this must be a bit of a change from working with someone like Bayer, where, as you say, there was international travel every couple of weeks, you know, much like a lot of people in the industry. So how has the change been for you? Because going from such a large global organization to, you know, founding a startup like your own, what's been the biggest difference? What have you liked and what have you not liked?
I would say one of the biggest differences was I was so used to having to be up early in the morning. I would work from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. almost every day. Wow. Because the, you know, German colleagues were up early and I needed to meet with them. And then I still had the U.S. colleagues and things. And sometimes I would have some scattered meetings in the evenings for China, you know, doing some 9 p.m., 10 p.m. calls as well. So that regulating my calendar has been kind of fabulous. I still have occasionally, because I am still working globally. That's the funny thing. I have people in other countries still wanting to work with me, but it's not consistent. So I like that. The one thing I think I miss the most is my team. I had an amazing team over at Bayer, and the people energized me as much as I energized them. And so that's really difficult. I'm lucky with my company now. I created a group of subject matter experts, and they don't work for me, but they work with me, and they come with different backgrounds and things. So I'm able to interact with them and feel like I have a team. So I'm not just on my own somewhere. Yeah. And we'll get to do a holiday party and stuff like that. So I won't miss out on too much of it, but it's very different.
So is that the setup at the moment? Because look, again, if you kind of launched September, we're talking like not long ago. So is it mainly it's yourself? And as you say, you surrounded yourself by a few experts to pitch in where it's needed. And I'm assuming, you know, looking at your background, that you are working from the home office. I commented before that it looks like a trophy cabinet in the background. So how are you enjoying that setup and the kind of the work-life balance? But sometimes, you know, being at home is a different challenge in itself. How have you found that side of things? And what would you say has perhaps been the biggest challenge, you know, in the change?
I like working from home for a lot of reasons, but I miss going in and talking to other people. Ideas happen when people get together and sporadically, and sometimes you miss that. Even if you have a meeting with people, you're going to talk about whatever your scheduled topic was. You don't have that conversation just about random stuff that you're going through or what have you. So I miss that kind of interaction some. I'm lucky because we're in conference season. So right now, September through all the way through December, I'm going every other week to a different conference and I'm speaking at these and doing different interactions that way. So I get it, but I'm a little nervous about once conference season slows down, having those idea generation moments like before.
You have to start speaking to the dogs a bit more, Michelle, and see what ideas they can come up with, right?
Yeah, I'm working on one of those voice modulators, you know, like they had an up so that I can actually understand what they're saying, but it just doesn't seem to be quite working right. Maybe Adam can help me with that.
Dear me. And look, in terms of, you know, it's early days since you've started, you know, I'm impressed with the fact that, you know, there's so many people by the sounds of things that already have wanted to work with yourself and you know, looking to work with you. Yeah, what's been the biggest achievement to date where you're like, you know, kind of, holy shit, I'm so glad I did this?
So I have one company and they really realized that they needed a user voice strategy and they didn't have one before. And I actually thought that the company was pretty advanced for their innovation style and way of working and things like that. And I told the gentleman, I said, you know, CEO of the company, I said, I don't think you need me. I really don't think you need my services. I don't think you need me. He goes, I still want to talk to you. And I said, I think you're like at a 90%. You're not 100, but you're at a 90%. You're doing pretty good. I don't think you need me. So we had the call and he dropped the bomb that he has no user voice strategy. But when he said, I realized after talking to you, I need this and we need this as a company. And I want you to help us get there. That was like a massive achievement for me because that's one of the biggest pieces that I think we need in order to be able to innovate faster and really make things that are not only fit for purpose, which we always talk about things fit for purpose, but also fit for person. And that's the next piece. And if we can do fit for purpose and fit for person, then we're really going to be able to do good things.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. So look, in terms of, you know, that, so you've, that's certainly one client success story. You know, what are the plans moving forward? At the moment, you're surrounding yourself with a few experts. Are you going to be looking to grow, go more global, have people overseas, you know, double down in certain areas? What does the roadmap, I guess, look like for yourself?
So I'm already looking at a couple different things with the company. One thing is the innovation workshops and user testing workshops, those things don't have to be done by me, which is nice. So I can hire people to do some of those things. Some of the business consulting, my experience, I have to kind of continue to give that. But because of the workshops, I can hire more people. I'm hoping to be able to hire some starting probably middle of next year in other parts of the world. So there'll be some local people there. So I don't have to travel and go do those workshops myself and be able to get them all trained up to do it. So that's exciting. And there's growth opportunities for sure. And eventually I don't want to work forever. So there could also be a chance to be able to have a lot of these things handed over to other people in the next 5 to 10 years, but we'll see how we go.
That'll be a case of trying to systemize and put you know, things in place, because you know, at the moment it seems like the big selling point is you and your knowledge and how you've got a way of, you know, painting a picture really for your clients that makes sense. And I guess that's sometimes, it's a blessing and a curse, isn't it? I guess sometimes.
It is. You don't want to end up boxing yourself into a corner where you can't continue to grow or do other things. So, but the nice thing is we know that in every company, there's about 25% of people that are truly innovative talent and they look at things differently. They see things on the bigger picture. They're able to empathize with the different roles. So if I can find more people like that and bring them in and make our company even more than 25% of those, you know, predominantly those kind of people, then that could be an amazing service for lots of clients out there.
Definitely. Well, look, it'll be good to see how everything goes with this. I know that we're, yeah, as I say, so new into your journey as a founder. So it'll be great to keep an eye on things. But look, to close the show, we typically wrap up with a quick fire questions round to get some insight and some wisdom from all of our guests. So I'll kick us off here and just ask, you know, what would be the one piece of advice that you would give to your younger self, Michelle?
I would say, don't be afraid to create your destiny. So sometimes I would see opportunities throughout my career path and I thought, this is an unmet need at this company and I know I could fill it, but I was too shy to say, hey, let me do this for you. And as my career continued, the last several years of it, I changed and I started doing that. And I actually created roles for myself. And that really helped me, you know, work through the jungle gym of that career situation. It's not a career ladder anymore. It's really a jungle gym type situation. So I would say if I could have known to do that sooner, I would have probably even been further ahead than I am now.
Incredible. And I mean, now that's how you created your own business and your own lifestyle and everything else. So no, amazing, like that.
Michelle, a lot of our listeners like to know what resources, what books, what podcasts you might be listening to. Is there anything particularly that you've gained some pearls of wisdom from that you'd like to share with our audience?
So I just read a book. Hold on, I am pulling it up. It's called Ask Powerful Questions and Create Conversations That Matter. Highly recommend this. It's great for having a dialogue around, you know, what is really necessary in the world? What are things we're not thinking about and what should we know about? And I also would recommend, I'm listening to Brad Hightower's Note to File podcast right now and listening to things from the sight side of the world, you know, and having been there for 9 years, it really is impactful to me to hear some of the things that they're talking about and some of the pain points. So I really enjoy that one as well.
Shout out to Brad. I mean, he's great. I've also been on Note to File. But also, I said to him many times, he has a voice for radio, that guy, doesn't he?
Yes, oh, he does. Oh, my God.
He's perfect. He's fabulous. He's fabulous. Thank you for that.
Got to say it. Yeah, do love a bit of that. Brad Hightower, the man himself. And look, you've brought in a few subject matter experts, as you say. As you move forward, look, there may well be further growth. But in terms of, I guess, general qualities that you value when... No, either working in a team or building a team, Michelle, what would be your top three if you had to pinpoint them?
So I am, whenever I build a team, I'm always looking at their soft skills more than their hard skills, because hard skills I can teach, but are they open-minded? Are they curious? Do they ask a lot of questions? Are they willing to question the status quo? And when they do that, are they also willing to share their ideas? Do they feel free enough to fail? Mm-hmm. Because sometimes when you share your ideas, it's not going to go over, but sometimes it could be the next greatest thing ever. So those are the things that I look for. And I think adaptability to change is also a key thing. If people are very stuck in where they are, you're not going to be able to move forward as easily in this world as you need to be, especially in an innovation type role.
I was going to say, certainly for what you do, that all of those things are an absolute must haves, aren't they, really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a great answer. And to follow on from that, I have this mantra, which is success is failure turned inside out. And I also have a very favorite podcast called How to Fail, which is on the topic of learning from your biggest failures. Namely, you know, you've got to fail to succeed. If you're not failing, you're not trying. That's the point.
I love that.
It? Yeah. What is your favorite thing outside of work, aside of your two dogs?
Oh, travel. Travel is my favorite thing. And I love seeing places, but the people I love so much more. I love to get immersed into a culture and figure out how do they think and how do they work and what kind of, you know, things really matter and shake their world and which things do they love and enjoy. And then I have to try all of it. So that's absolutely my favorite thing. So
travel. Any favorite locations, Michelle, while we're on that subject, just to expand on that one quickly?
I think that Bali is my next place I'm headed, and I have a feeling that that's going to be amazing, but I haven't been there yet. So if I look back to where I have been so far, my favorite location has been Hawaii, because there's so many different landscapes and everything looks different. It was the first place that I ever flew back home thinking, how do I move there? So many places I've been. The standing on the Great Wall of China was an amazing experience to me. I remember being a little kid imagining what it would be like, thinking I'd never get there. And then actually getting to do it was like just a whole different feeling. So
the scale of it is ridiculous, isn't it?
It's enormous. And to think of how many people have walked on that wall before and how many people gave their lives to build the wall and what has, you know, happened since then, the fact you can see it from outer space, it was just amazing. It was absolutely amazing.
Excellent stuff. Well, I hope my microphone is still working. I just had something flash up on my screen saying it wasn't. But to close the show, Michelle, we always finish off with a bit of a deeper question. But what would you say is your number one golden rule for both life and business?
Always follow your purpose. So my purpose is helping people, and I have a special affinity to help patients. But no matter what I do, I'm always my authentic self and I always follow that purpose. So I know I can't go wrong. And that means that I'll be amazing at whatever I do as long as I'm connected to that. So golden circle, you know, start with why.
that links back to our last podcast, James, where we talked about Knowing Your Why by Simon Sinek.
Yes, exactly. Love that.
Amazing. Amazing.
Indeed, indeed. Well, look, Michelle, it's been a pleasure hearing about the, I guess, your back journey as much as anything else, and how you've almost, you've carved out this new career for yourself, haven't you? By choice, you know, it's, you've gone out, you've done it, you've taken that leap. So I'm always impressed by that sort of thing. So look, for anyone that, you know, wants to follow your story, am I correct in thinking that you also have a podcast yourself, I believe? Is that right?
I'm launching a podcast in January, so it's coming. I recorded my first session. Well, I didn't record it. That's a funny thing. I thought I was recording my first session, and then I never pushed the record button. So that one went away. Had to do it again. And now I have a couple leading up, so that we'll launch them in January. Awesome. But yeah, so I will be there. But for now, you can find me at innovateinwhatyoudo.com. I also have a TikTok, Innovate in What You Do, and Instagram, Innovate in What You Do. So you'll find me around.
Oh, you are on all of the socials, Michelle. Loving it. Well, look, yeah. For everyone tuning in, look, keep an eye out for Michelle's podcast. Go look her up. Check out TikTok, Instagram. Look, Michelle, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the podcast. Thanks again for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.